drive to create things. You're a writer, a photographer, a musician, a maker. You're ready to make things happen.
But chasing creative isn't always easy. Your time and energy go to your work, your family, and your life. Is it really possible to make space for the creative in your everyday?
Here at the Chasing Creative Podcast, we believe you can. We're everyday creatives who have insights and action steps you can take today to make your creative plans happen.
I'm Ashley Brooks, a freelance writer and editor at Brooks Editorial and a work-at-home mom of two. I would love to devote more time to creative writing, journaling, and blogging.
And I'm Abigail Creeves, a writer and photographer behind Inkwells and Images. I'm also a work-at-home mom who is just beginning to learn the ropes of balancing a baby and everything else.
And you are listening to the Chasing Creative Podcast. Welcome to Season 4, Episode 23. Today we are talking about creativity on a budget, because we all have limited resources to dedicate to our creative lives, and one of those is money. No matter what your financial situation is, money is always a finite resource, and we can only spend so much on creative pursuits. And between creative supplies, website costs, books and classes, creative retreats, the cost can add up pretty quickly. So how do we budget for creative projects when we're not independently wealthy? That is the topic we're tackling today. So, Abby, neither of us are very, like, I don't know, like, upper echelon trust fund kids. So how do we handle this whole idea of creativity on a budget? Do you have a line item in your household budget for creative projects?
Kind of. Not specifically for creativity, but both Scott and I get an allowance, for lack of a better word. I'm air quoting that word allowance as well. It just seems so juvenile. But we each get kind of this bit of money that we can each spend guilt-free and in any way we'd like, no questions asked. Like, you don't have to justify it to your partner. You don't have to ask before you spend it. As long as you're only spending what you get or what you've amassed over the last few months, you can spend it however you want. So I tend to use this for books or my camera equipment, or even if I want to, you know, go out for coffee with a friend. Any of those kinds of things tend to fall under this little Abby fund, is what I call it, and Scott has a Scott fund. So that's kind of a way to make it a little, feel a little less like I'm spending money on myself that maybe I shouldn't be, and instead allows me to spend it without having to think twice, which is nice.
Yep, exactly. That's pretty much right on the nose to what Jacob and I do, where we each get our spending money for the month, and you can either save some of it towards a bigger purchase down the road, or, you know, just as little things come up that you feel like buying. So for me, it's really just a matter of making those creative things like books or supplies or whatever a priority, which they pretty much always are. Most of my allowance money goes towards books, coffee, and yarn. But every now and then I'll be like, oh, I would like something that's not strictly a necessity, but, you know, like I want a new necklace at Target or a new purse or something like that. And those things, because they cost more for whatever reason, like a purse is like, you know, $30 to $50, that eats up like more of my budget than, you know, books, obviously, because books are much cheaper than that, especially if you're buying them on Kindle. So it's easier for me to think like, oh, do I really want this thing though? Because I could buy this many books for that same amount. So it's, for me, it's really about prioritizing creativity with the money I've got.
Yeah. When you're looking at, you know, a cool shirt that's $14.99, you're like, but that's a new hardcover. And I think I'd much rather have the book.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find, and I think this is the same for you too. Now that I'm running my own business, a lot of things that I use for my business also kind of help my personal creativity. Like my blog website is the same as my business website. And so I can kind of pay for some of that either in part or in full from my business account. And so that kind of gives me a bit of an added boost in the budget department, provided I'm making enough money in the business to fund those things without chipping in from my own account.
Yeah. Yep, I do something similar. My business and my personal websites are separate, so I can't do that one from the business account, but I can do like a lot of my magazine purchases, which I don't always buy magazines. I'm that person who likes to flip through them in the store because I read them so quickly it doesn't always seem worth it. Mm-hmm. But one that comes to mind that I like to buy is Bella Grace. They've got, you know, longer essays that are worth reading again, maybe, and going back to. And I really love that magazine and I would like to submit to them someday. And so I consider that research for my writing career, I guess. And so that one I will buy from the business account, and certain things like that, that I will, if I can legally justify them, I will pay for things like that from the business. Or like if there's a book I want to read, but it's business related, I will buy that from the business account. That's probably where I spend the most money that way.
Yeah. I've never actually thought about buying business books for the business account. That's a new revelation. I have an appointment with my tax guy this week, so I should talk to him about that.
Oh, yeah. If it's directly related, like
a book about writing.
Yeah, well, like books about writing or books about, I've bought editing books before. I've bought like even the kind of like businessy mindset books. I tend to get those more from the library. Mm-hmm. But if there's one that I think I'm going to want to refer back to, I can buy that through the business account because it's applicable. So it's considered, you know, continuous education or learning or however the IRS likes to categorize those things.
Nice. I'm going to take a leaf out of your book and look into that this year.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think too, like as Arthur gets older or any other kids that we have get older, how do you keep your kids, I guess, piles of papers and stickers and markers and things? Like, does that come out of a household budget, or do you have a kind of like kids stuff budget or like creativity for the family budget or anything like that?
Yeah. So our budget line items that relate to the kids are clothing, which is necessary clothing for anybody in the family. So that includes me and Jacob. And Jacob does not shop for fun. So that's like when his clothes wear out. Yes. Or when the kids are in a new size. And the same for me. I use that for like I'm fluctuating sizes between pregnancies or something. I have a legitimate need for new clothes. This is not just shopping for fun. That's that. And then all the other kids' stuff is in a fund called Kids Necessities. And that is anything from diapers and wipes to new sippy cups to, I don't know. I guess we don't put their gifts, like birthday gifts and things in there because we have a separate fund where all of our gift money for anybody goes to. So their birthday and Christmas presents come out of the gift fund. But this Kids Necessities is where I would stock up on those creative art supplies if I needed to. And I find that I don't really have to that often because when their birthdays and Christmas do come around, people always want ideas for what to get them. And after clothes, art supplies are the things I'm most likely to ask for because they are a finite resource. Mm-hmm. They get used up. And if we get, you know, 15 packs of markers, I just keep 14 of them, you know, stashed away until all the first pack is used up and dried out. And then I bring out another one. And so things like Play-Doh and glitter glue that the kids really tend to go through quickly, those sorts of things I'm always asking for on their gift lists. And I don't always need to restock on our own then.
Oh, that is really smart. I will have to remember that because I know I keep thinking like as Arthur gets older, I'm going to need watercolors and all of that stuff. And I really want to show him that, you know, this creative stuff is worth their time and their attention and their money. But having to do that in a semi-frugal way is good.
Yeah. Well, and we also do two other things. We do toy rotation. So art supplies get rotated out with all their other toys just because we don't have space to have all of them out at the same time. So there's a week by week toy rotation. And so 1 week the watercolors might be up and the next week it might be the Play-Doh. And stuff like crayons and markers and paper are always available, but then those other more specialty items aren't always. And then things like stickers. You know, the kids will go through an entire pack of stickers in like 30 seconds. And so my rule with that is kind of just like when you're out of stickers, you're out of stickers. Like they are a finite resource. And not that I want my kids to learn that it's good to like, I don't know, to be precious with their supplies, to not use what they really want to use. I'm not trying to do that. But I do want them to recognize that, like, these things have a cost, and you need to think carefully about what you use and how much you use. And things like stickers that are relatively cheap and kind of a throwaway item are probably a good place to teach that.
Yeah. No, that's really smart.
Yeah. So that's how we do that.
Yeah, and I think for both of us, having kind of that allowance where we know we can spend money on our creativity without kind of any guilt is probably what makes us able to do it without second guessing ourselves or if it's worth it or not.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, and that was the next thing we were going to talk about, which is how do we battle the guilt that comes with spending money on something that is technically unnecessary? And I think that having that designated budget is really a smart way to do that, because otherwise, if you don't have a budget, there would always be that nagging feeling like, well, I could spend $10 on this book, or that could be $10 that's going towards my kid's college fund. Am I a terrible mother for, you know, wanting to buy a book? And having the budget actually gives you more space and more freedom to get away from that guilt, I feel like.
I completely agree. And I feel like, too, a lot of the times when I would spend money on my creative stuff before we had this kind of budget in place, I would always have to justify my purchases by making sure they made me money later, i.e., like, we're a good return on investment, which is stressful. And so I wouldn't recommend that for anybody. But one way you can think about it is that it's an investment in yourself, too. And I think a lot of times we forget that mental health is just as important, and oftentimes more important than maybe physical or financial health even. Obviously, going into debt for your creativity is not advised here or anywhere else. That probably won't help your mental health in the long run. But I think spending $20 here or there to make you feel more like yourself is probably a really great investment in the long run if you have to look at it like that.
Yes, I totally agree. And related to that, I realized that the thing that I feel most guilty about spending money on would be hiring a babysitter so that I could go somewhere and take a creative retreat or work on a creative project or just, you know, wander through a bookstore because I feel like it and not work. Like, I have no problem hiring a babysitter. Well, I kind of do. I still am always like, what's my hourly rate versus the babysitter's hourly rate? But if I know that I'm going to be doing billable client work, I'm like, yes, for sure, I will hire a babysitter to cover that time. But if I'm just going to go spend some time by myself, I feel so much guilt about that, even if I'm using money that was specifically set aside for a sitter. And I'm like, I have chosen to spend my money in a way that gets me a little bit of free time to work on a creative project. I really struggle with that for some reason. So that's something I think I need to get better about, because that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think you feel alone in that by any means. I know this year, one thing that I have been doing, which I'm very grateful that Scott is willing to jump in on this with me, is one Saturday a month, I have been leaving the house, and Arthur and Scott hang out at home together, and I get out of the house guilt-free and go kind of do whatever I want. And usually at least an hour or two is spent on work in some way, shape, or form. But for like the first couple of months, it was like, this feels really rich. Like, should I need this? Like, is this something that I even should be doing as a mom, kind of thing? And it wasn't even spending money. It was just spending time in a different way, which I think a lot of the times our guilt can be wrapped up into either one or both of those, time and money.
Yeah, that is very true, because you're sitting there thinking like, oh, I should be spending time with my family, because if, like, that's a big thing for me, because Jacob works oftentimes on Saturdays as well as the rest of the week, and Sunday is our only day where we're all home together. And so it feels very selfish almost for me to take any time on a Sunday where he's home with the kids and be like, yeah, I'm just going to not be here for a few hours, because it's like family day, basically. And it's, even though it doesn't happen very often, it does still feel very indulgent, like you said. Like, do I really need to do this? Why am I doing this? So yeah, budgeting maybe your time as well as your money, and remembering, like you said, that mental health and investing in yourself are always worthwhile is probably very good for most people.
Yeah. I think so. And I think I've even learned over the past couple of months that that day is really good for me to get out of the house and kind of reset and just be a person for a while. And I find that I come back a little bit more refreshed than I was the day before. And I find myself looking forward to those days too, and not in a way like, oh my goodness, I can't wait until that day gets here. But like, hey, on Saturday, I get to leave the house and I don't have to carry the diaper bag with me. And so that has been just really good, like, as a mindset. Having something to look forward to has been, I think, just as much an important part of the process as the day itself, actually.
Yeah. And I know that whenever I do take those rare moments to get out of the house, or if there's, you know, a babysitter day and I'm able to not spend the whole thing on work or whatever, it makes me a better mom when mm-hmm. I come home, because I have so much more patience with my kids. And it's like you got to refill and refuel your own energy. And instead of being, I don't know, it sounds bad, but resentful of your kids mm-hmm. for always taking so much of you, you're able to actually pour back into them and be like a better parent to your children, and probably also like a better spouse and a better friend, mm-hmm. just a better human being in general.
Yes. And I imagine you're also a better daughter or son or roommate, if that's the case, if the people that mm-hmm. you live with are just taking everything you have and you need to get away from them, or you need to spend some money to go out to dinner by yourself or something to that effect, just to recharge your own person. I think that that's maybe an investment you should consider.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. So as writers, primarily, you and I do have relatively cheap-ish hobbies compared to what some people have, but what are the areas that we spend the most on in our own creative lives, and how do we make those expenses a little bit more budget-friendly?
Yeah, writing, like you said, is pretty cheap. Pen and paper is really all you need, although these days you also need a computer and internet access if you want to be part of the writing community, because so much of it is online. I find that the thing that I spend the most money on, like, as far as dollar signs go over the years, has been photography equipment. Mm-hmm. Even though I haven't bought anything in a few years, the equipment itself is really pricey and takes a long time to save for, especially if you're just using your tiny little allowance each month. So one thing that I learned is that I can actually rent equipment from my local camera store, and that lets me try things out or use really big expensive lenses for weddings or other events, and I don't have to own them myself. And that has been pretty awesome. And they also resell used equipment that they buy, which can help cut costs too. So you can buy lenses that are gently used but at a fraction of their MSRP, which is really nice.
Yeah, that is so smart, and not something that I would have thought of. Especially since I'm not like in the photography world, but that's a great tip, because so many of our listeners are into photography, or they mm-hmm. wish that they could get more into photography, but they feel like it's cost prohibitive. So that's a fantastic tip. For me, I will say that I don't spend that much money on creative stuff, just because my most expensive hobby is knitting, and that's, like, if you're buying expensive, fancy yarn and you're going to make something huge like a blanket with it, yeah, that's going to cost you several hundred dollars. But if you, you know, can stick to cheaper yarn or save the really nice splurgy yarn for smaller projects so that it's affordable, then, you know, it's not such a big deal. So for me, the thing that I really would like to spend a lot of money on that I don't, just because of the season of life I'm in right now, is things like writing coaching or writing workshops, and maybe even a writing retreat that's a little bit more formal or structured, where I get to like get away and yes. like maybe book a hotel, or, you know, even drive 2 hours away or something. So those are things that I would like to be able to do, but they are not, they're just not fitting with the season of life I'm in right now, so they haven't happened. But I could see that even in 5 years being where I spend most of my money, and then needing to go, okay, I have to spend like several months planning for this and saving up for this. And I also need to look at cheap options like, you know, staying at Airbnbs that might be cheaper than a hotel, that kind of a thing, rather than renting a cabin by myself, which is probably going to be hugely expensive. So those things will probably be coming up in the next 5 to 10 years. They just haven't yet.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think you looking forward to that is really smart too, because it is something that I think every creative person needs, is that string of time that is all at once. And I think it's Emily Freeman that mentioned something about writing, having back-to-back writing days is so much more, I guess, progress oriented for her, because like the first day you spend getting in the attitude of writing, and the second day you can actually just jump in full force and the whole day is productive instead of just half of it. So I think you're wanting to get away for a weekend or a couple of days back to back is really a smart investment too of both your time and your money when you get to that point where you want to do it and can do it.
Yeah, totally. And I guess my only other advice for, because I'm not in the world of like, I know that painting and all that kind of stuff can really add up and get expensive quickly. And I guess my only other advice for people who are in that realm would be to, you know, see if there's a friend or if you have a connection to someone who will let you borrow some of their stuff. I guess you'd be using it up, but, you know, like if there's a new type of paint you want to try or a new medium that you want to try, see if you have someone who will let you give theirs a little bit of a test run first so that you don't have to go out and make a huge investment in something if you're not sure if you're going to like it right away. Or as far as canvas goes, I don't, like, I'm not a painter, so I don't know for sure if this is a thing that works, but I have heard people say that you can buy like at thrift stores cheap paintings and then just paint over the existing canvas, like take it out of the frame and then just reuse the canvas. I don't know if that's, would that actually work?
You can. I think it probably depends on the, like the canvas that you pick up, if it's like already textured or not, depending on what paint they used. But something that's really common in acrylic and oil, at least what I did in high school and college, was you can buy this kind of, it's like a primer, like even like for a wall, but it's called gesso, G-E-S-S-O, and you just mix it with water and you paint over what's already there, and it gives you a blank white canvas to start on again.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, that is an option. But you know, that's a really good point about being able to like borrow someone else's stuff just to dip your toes in and see if you like it. Like start on a really small canvas, borrow someone else's acrylics, give it a spin, see if you like it, rather than have to buy 18 different colors in order to make the one project that you want to make and then use a teaspoon of each for that project and never touch them again.
Yeah, exactly. And like in the realm of knitting and crocheting and that kind of thing, like if you're going to spend money on really nice yarn, like have a plan for it so that you at least know. Like, don't just wander through the store and impulse buy a skein of yarn, because then you're going to find a project that needs two skeins of yarn and you're never going to use that one that you bought. You're just going to look at it because you don't have enough of it. Or, you know, if you are a brand new knitter or crocheter, like, don't jump right into the high-end stuff because your first projects are not going to be good. They're just not. You're going to look back at them someday and be like, oh, my technique has gotten so much better since then. So
why did I spend $80 to make that one pair of socks?
Exactly. Like, don't start out at the fancy yarn shop, which I know is tempting because they usually have the best classes and the nice yarn, and they're usually independent and you want to support them. But I mean, Hobby Lobby has skeins of yarn for like $2, you guys. Just start with that.
Start there and get better.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that idea. And you also made a really good point, too, about using the library, which is something both you and I do, but I had no I just didn't even cross my mind to put it on our little outline here. But if you want to read more books, but you can't buy more books, go to the library. They're wonderful and free, and your tax dollars pay for them.
Mm-hmm. And that is actually something I do like every year. That's, you know, you get that if you're a homeowner, you get this like tax proposition for the coming year, and it tells you like where all your taxes are going as a property owner. And I always look at the line item for the library and I'm like, okay, how much money a year are we giving to the library? I want to make sure I'm using at least that much in books rented, and I'm like probably easily double it. We are only sending, I guess I don't know what's average around the country or whatever, but it's only like $80 a year for us that goes to our library. And I'm like, well, I know the library is saving me at least twice that on books, probably much, much more. So I'm like, all right, there we go. So look at your tax line and see how much you need to be using the library to break even and make that your goal.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great way to look at it. So do you have any other tips for saving money toward creative projects?
Yeah, so especially some of those bigger things that you might need to take a couple of months and save up for. I like to think about the opportunity cost of things before I spend money on anything. So like, think about what you could be buying if you didn't spend money on the thing that's right in front of you. Like you were saying earlier, like with the t-shirt, if you look at a t-shirt and you're like, but that could also pay for a book, you have to decide which one's more important to you and which one you want to prioritize. Mm-hmm. So that can lead to slow decision making, but it can also help you kind of delay gratification so that you can save up for maybe bigger projects in the future that might take a bigger chunk of money.
Yeah. I can't remember where I heard this or saw this. It was a blogger who was talking, I think it was a blogger who was talking about how she paid off her student debt. And she, anytime that she went through Target and like was walking towards the register with say $30 of stuff she didn't need, they were all impulse buys, she would rethink it. She would set all those things down and she would take 30, she would get out her smartphone and put $30 towards her student loan principal instead, like right there in the aisle, so that it was kind of instant gratification of paying down her debt as opposed to the instant gratification of like checking out with items she didn't need at the checkout. And I thought that was so smart. So just kind of one little example of how putting off a purchase that you maybe think you need now or think you want or think you need, it might help you fund a bigger creative goal later if you just kind of pause and think about it, even give it 24 hours.
Yeah, I really, really like that because I think that's what's so tough is saving for something in the future or saving for, like so often with creative projects, you don't quite know where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. So you might be thinking like, oh, I'd like to go to this blogging conference next year, or I would like to save up and take a creative retreat, but there's so many other variables in flux that you just don't know if your schedule's going to line up or if you're going to have enough money or if it's going to work out right, you know? And so being able to just like put something aside in its own little fund right there in that moment gives you more of that motivation when it's otherwise kind of hard to predict. Like, will this really happen? Because then even if it doesn't, you've got a good chunk of money. And maybe if you can't make it to that conference, you can make it to a different one that's a little bit cheaper or closer to home or something.
Yeah. No, that's really smart. So, yeah, definitely set up a separate fund if that's the kind of thing that motivates you, too. We've talked about what you find what motivates you and use it to achieve your goals. If having, like, that separate savings account at your bank that says, you know, that just for you is earmarked like this is for my creative stuff, and any money that goes in the account you can spend on your creative projects makes you that much more excited when you can transfer money to that account, even if it is standing in line at the Target checkout and celebrating that you didn't spend money on things you don't actually need.
Yes, exactly. Did you have any other tips about saving money towards creative projects?
Not really tips about saving money so much as just making sure that you do use what you already have. I know a lot of the time in the past, I have been like, oh, well, if I just get that shiny new notebook, I will write more. Or if I just get that new set of calligraphy pens, I'll totally use them. And I think we fall into that trap a lot when the pens that I have in my desk are perfectly good. I just don't make the time to use them. So I think if you aren't using maybe the art supplies that are already in your closet, you have to justify the new purchase because will you actually use the new ones? So using what you have first, I think, is a great tip for saving money because you're not spending it, which is the biggest savings you can have. But I know for camera stuff too, one tip that I've read over and over is only buy new equipment once you've maxed out learning on what you currently own. And at least for, you know, DSLR photography, that takes a while. Like, there are hundreds of settings on my camera that I have not even found yet, I'm sure. I don't know how to do everything. But as soon as I did learn that, and as soon as I was actually bored with my own equipment and I've maxed out my capabilities on them, that's when I would probably consider finding a new lens or upgrading bodies or something like that.
Yeah, that's a really smart tip. I like both of those, because if you are not using what you already have, or like with the camera stuff, if you're not using it to its fullest potential, then maybe the problem isn't so much that you don't have money for your creative projects. Maybe it's just a problem of time and motivation, and you need to go back and dig more into those root problems before you just start trying to amass a lot of stuff to make yourself feel better about not actually doing your creative work.
Yeah, I don't think either of us are talking from experience at all here. No.
Oh, no, not at all. There are not like three baskets full of yarn looking at me right now from my desk that have never been touched.
Yep. That's. I think I have an entire shelf sitting next to me on my desk here that are books that I was going to read at some point. That I should still probably read.
So. Yeah, the books you're going to read shelf is a tough one for me, because sometimes I buy a book because it's on sale, mm-hmm. or I feel like reading it in that moment, and then the moment passes and I'm like, oh no, now I don't feel like reading it right now, and there's other new shiny books.
Mm-hmm. Or then all your library holds come in at the same time and you're trying to read 14 books before they have to be back.
Yes, exactly. Oh, that's a true struggle for book nerds. But
it is.
Oh, anyway, so
yeah, speaking of struggles, any thoughts on turning creative projects into money-making ventures, or at least something that maybe pays for itself, whether that venture is for better or for worse?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts about this this section. I wrote like a manifesto on her outline, because I was like, I have so many words to say to people. So I'll try to keep it somewhat concise. But I think in this world of online creative entrepreneurship and everybody starting up an Etsy shop, and it's just, it seems natural to want to make money off of your creativity, because... And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because if it can pay for itself, or if it can bring in a little bit of extra money for your family, that's kind of cool. But it also has the potential to take over your life in ways that I think many people don't recognize. So my biggest tip for people is to know exactly why they think they want to earn money from their creativity. So is your goal to cover your costs? Or is it to save up for new supplies, like something expensive, like a new camera or a new lens, or to save up for a creative retreat, or maybe just to earn a little bit of extra money because you've got a bunch of like knitted mittens lying around your house that nobody actually needs. And you're like, hey, maybe I could sell these to someone who needs them, because I've done that before. It's easy to get sucked into being a creative entrepreneur for the wrong reasons, but that will take all the fun out of your creativity and out of your hobby if your why is not aligned with your business model. Because as soon as you start looking online for tips on Etsy or on how to sell your stuff, you're going to get sucked into social media, and you're going to get sucked into blogging, and you're going to start taking courses on from people who say that you can earn six figures from your crafting. And it gets to be a lot, and it's running a full-blown business, which is a lot different than just selling your artwork here and there because it's fun. Mm-hmm. So that's just, I think that's my biggest thing, is to just know your why, know what you want to achieve by selling stuff, and then be realistic about it when you start trying to sell things. If you do go the online route, don't worry about doing everything that people say that you have to do. Like, be professional, run your business legally, and pay your taxes if you are going to owe taxes. But don't try to do every single thing the online gurus are telling you to do, because they're assuming that you want to become a millionaire. And if that's not your goal, then listening to them is never going to get you where you want to be.
That is so smart. And I see your manifesto continues, if you would like to continue.
It does. My last little bit to that is that everybody turns online these days for selling their stuff because it's convenient and everybody is online. It's like the world is your oyster, you know. But if your goal is relatively small, like if you just want your creative projects to pay for themselves, or if you just really enjoy making art, but you don't need all these canvases lying around your house, you would rather see them go to somebody who would enjoy them in their home. You don't need to get into all the crazy stuff of running an online business. You can keep your work pretty local and achieve those goals. So you could go to independent coffee shops and ask if they have a program where they display and sell local artwork. You could bring your jewelry to a small local boutique and see if they'd be interested in selling it for you. You can ask friends if you can add your latest collection of knitted goods to their garage sales, which is, you know, that's me. I'm raising my hand over here. And then, you know, just telling people like, hey, I have this stuff, just word of mouth, old fashioned, like letting people know that you make this thing, and like people will probably buy your stuff, and it's not going to be a full-time income, mm-hmm. but it is a good way to earn a little bit of money without necessarily needing to get into all of that messy online business world.
Yeah, it'll at least help you buy the yarn for your next project, and then that project can fund the next project, and you can keep being creative without spending your own cash money on it, in theory.
Yes, exactly, because so often you just want to make something, but you don't necessarily have a purpose for it. Like, I want to knit this hat, but I don't need a hat, and my kids don't need a hat right now. So, I mean, you can always, obviously, like in that case, donate it to a homeless shelter or something like that. But, you know, if it's art or pottery or making earrings or whatever, you might not necessarily need to keep that thing for yourself. And it's a good way to just share it with other people and maybe earn back the cost of supplies.
Yeah. No, I love all of that. I thought that was really well thought out, and I didn't want to interrupt whatsoever. So thank you for your thoughts. As someone who has taken a business and or a hobby, editing and that sort of thing, and taken it into a full-blown business that does pay your bills, it's a lot of work. And it's maybe not what you want to spend your evenings and weekends doing, unless you were to quit your full-time job and then you just have the stress of making your part-time job become your full-time job, and that's a struggle too. So my advice was a little less intense, I'm going to say. I loved everything you had to say about, you know, don't open an Etsy shop as like your first line of defense for getting your knitted hat stash out of your house. But if you do decide to go the route of opening an Etsy shop, vow to never take custom orders would be my first suggestion. I have a friend who is a brilliant woodworker, and custom orders are the bane of his existence, because they never turn out exactly how the person who does not know how to do that craft envisions it. So if you want to keep doing your creativity and at least pay yourself back for those supplies, like knit the style of hat you want to knit and put it online. And if someone wants it, bonus. If not, you still got to make that cool hat that you wanted to make in the first place. And I think a lot of creative burnout comes from when we start using our gift in a way that doesn't actually make us happy. So that would be kind of my advice, is just don't take custom orders unless that is the route you want to go and you want to start essentially selling your time and selling your craft and kind of shaping it to be what other people want it to be and not what you want it to be. Otherwise, a great service online if you want to sell like art prints or photographs as, you know, mugs or canvases or things like that. Society 6, and it's society and then the number 6.com, has a way that you can kind of license your stuff to do that. It looks to be like a pretty simple, I've never sold anything through that, but a really easy way to upload your designs and have them print things rather than you have to carry inventory and handle the shipping, because that makes selling your stuff just that much more expensive for the consumer, unless you're going to swallow those shipping dollars, which I think is also something we forget about a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very well said. I like that about when you start using your gifts in a way that don't make you happy, that's what really leads to burnout. And I can totally see that. Like, I can think of several people off the top of my head where I'm like, yep, that happened to this person and this person. And, you know, it all looks good on Instagram when you're, you know, sitting there doing your craft work or whatever and making money from it. But it is a different reality to live that. So just to be mindful of that.
And the other tip I have for photographers, it's something that I've always meant to do and just never have. If you don't want the stress of making a business out of your photography, but would like to earn a little extra here and there to help cover your equipment or your online hosting or anything like that, I recommend, and I've seen this work well, volunteering to do family and friend sessions as kind of a pay what you want opportunity for people. So you're not actually charging big wads of cash for your friends and family, which always feels kind of icky to take their photo. But you can be upfront and tell them, like, this is what you're doing. I want to earn money for my next lens. This is what I would usually charge for a 30-minute session. It would usually cost X number of dollars. But because you're friends or family, you can pay me whatever you can afford or whatever you want for this 30-minute photo session. And then you're not out any money because you already own the equipment you have, and any money that you do make from that kind of a setup, you can put towards whatever it is you're buying next, and with no stress to blow it out into a full-blown business.
Yeah, and that's also a great tip just for photographers in general when dealing with friends and family people, because I know there's that whole, you know, oh, I know so-and-so who takes photos and I just had a baby and maybe they'll take pictures of my baby for free. And like, it's awkward to handle those sorts of situations. And I think this is a really classy way to do it, is to tell someone like, well, this is what I normally charge and I'll run a pay what you can or pay what you're able to model. And like, it just is so much easier than giving like a strict friends and family discount, because then where does the line between friends and family shift over to, no, you're more of an acquaintance. You don't get that discount. Yeah. You know, it just, it takes a lot of that awkwardness away. So I think that's really smart. That can work in a lot of service industries, to be honest. Like, I have people who ask me to edit their resumes all the time, and things like that are so short that I never charge people for that. But if there were something longer that somebody wanted me to edit, or a writing project or something, that would be a really smart way of handling it.
Yeah, that is smart. And I think I've seen two creative people who have like a tip jar on their website where you can just like send them money via PayPal. So even if it is, and I do a lot of resume editing too, for the same reason, it's short, it's easy, and you know it's like directly impacting someone's livelihood, so you feel pretty good about doing it for free. But I think if you were ever kind of inundated with those requests, or someone is like, hey, would you edit my med school essay that's 20 pages long? You can be like, sure, this is what I normally charge per hour. It'll probably take me about 3 hours. Here's where you can tip me whatever you can afford, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes. So for all the service-based creatives out there, there's a good tip for you guys.
Have a tip jar.
So yeah, that's your tip. Have a tip jar. So before we get into Mini Book Club, we wanted to share the financial and budgeting resources that we use in case you are not happy with the way that you budget, or you've never really thought about setting up a budget before and just aren't sure where to start. So what do you use for budgeting, Abby?
Yeah, I use YNAB, which is the letter Y, the letter N, A, B. So it stands for You Need a Budget. It's a really cool system. It's a software that you download and use, but it's also a system that someone created that helps you, no matter kind of where you are at financially, get ahead. I think the goal is ahead an entire paycheck or an entire month of finances. So the software is set up, it's designed to like encourage you to save money so that you're paying today's bills with like two paychecks ago money, so that you're kind of ahead of things, even if you're not good at saving and budgeting. So we use that software, and it's really, it's a little time consuming. It's not as easy as like something online like Minted or whatever, where you can set stuff up to like automatically deduct from all of these accounts. But I find that having a little bit more hands-on time with my money means that I'm a little bit more intentional about where it goes. And I've also, I still use a plain old Excel spreadsheet for my business numbers. I don't have tons of transactions going in and out like our personal budget. And so I find that Excel is enough of a workhorse that I get the help I need, but don't spend tons of time managing it. What about you?
Yeah, so we do something similar. We use the Every Dollar app for our household budget, which was created by Dave Ramsey. And I think we are both Dave Ramsey fans.
Yes.
He is not for everybody, I will say, if you've never listened to him. He has a radio show and a podcast, and he does like a million different things now. But he can come across as like abrasive and aggressive to some people. But I really like him because I find that in the realm of getting your budget straight and your finances straight, especially if you're new to that sort of thing, his attitude really gets you motivated and leaves no room for excuses. We'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. He's not going to baby you. He's not going to let you whine about your situation. He's just going to tell you what you need to do to fix your money issues.
Yeah.
So one of his products is the Every Dollar app, and there's a free version or a paid version. I'm on the free version. We use that for our household budget, and that is it's pretty simple. It's a lot simpler than YNAB, which I used on trial several years ago, and I found it a little bit intimidating to set up. I don't think I spent enough time with it, really, and I went back to using just the spreadsheet that we had been using, and then I came across Every Dollar and was like, oh, this is simple. This works really well for me. So I think when it comes to those budgeting apps, you might need to play around and explore and see what works best for you and for your family. But I really like this one because it's a zero-based budget. So you put in how much income you're expecting to receive in a month, whether that's from, you know, your regular paychecks or from, you know, it's your birthday and you're expecting to get some gift money from people, things like that. Then you have to allocate every single dollar that you're planning on receiving to a different line item in your budget. And that includes savings, but it makes it so that there's no money left over. Not necessarily that there's no money left over in your checking account at the end of the month, but so that you have intentionally chosen where to put all of your money for the month rather than just going, oh, we have $50 left over. Maybe I'll save that. But then in reality, you won't because it's just $50 sitting there and it'll end up getting spent if you don't intentionally say, no, I am going to put that in savings. So it works really well for that. And then I use an app called Wave for my business finances. They are slightly more complicated. They're enough that I need to be able to categorize all of my different expenses, and I need to be able to attach receipts to those expenses, and Wave lets me just take a photo with my phone or forward an email receipt and it'll attach it to that particular line item. And it has invoicing, which I use for my clients and all that. So they are free. They've got a paid version that I don't need the features of, so I'm on the free one. But I've been pretty happy with them so far. So yeah, that's what I use.
That sounds really good. I might have to check into that. I haven't really needed anything more in the past, but this past year was the first year that I went full-time freelance, and I only worked about 6 months of the year. So this will be the first year that I'm trying to track receipts for an entire 12-month period, which may demand an upgrade of what I use.
Yeah. Yeah. Wave is pretty nice and convenient for that. And I will say that I also use those, like the printable budget trackers and savings thermometers and things that you can find like all over Pinterest for free. Those really help me if there's a particular goal that I'm trying to save for, whether it's a vacation or something creative related, whatever, because I'm such a visual person and money is kind of an abstract concept these days where we aren't usually actually handling physical money. So it's hard for me to remember that like you're actually spending things. And then it's hard for me to get motivated about savings. So oftentimes filling out one of those little printables and actually like seeing the money in the thermometer go up on the savings is really helpful to me. So if you are like a visual person like that, that also might be helpful. There's like millions of them on Pinterest. Yes. So that could help.
Yeah, that is really smart. I know I just like put a line in YNAB before saving for like a vacation, and I figure out how much the vacation's going to cost and just divide it by how many months between now and then put in YNAB, like we have to save this much a month in order to make it work. And that's how we do mm-hmm. it. But yeah, having a visual tracker might be more fun, and maybe like tape it to the dash of your car so that every time you're like, should we get takeout? You're like, no, we shouldn't.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So good conversation about kind of a tricky topic, I think, with budgeting and money, but hopefully that's helpful to some people. So with that, are we ready for mini book club?
I think so. Books, we are much, much more able to talk about than budgets.
Yes, this is much more our area of expertise and also an area where we are likely to spend most of our money if given the opportunity. So
it's true. So what have you been reading lately?
So I just recently finished Euphoria by Lily King. And for any of our longtime listeners, way back in season one, this is the book, the library book that I lost. I'm pretty sure Hadley threw it away. So you, Abby, recommended this book to me. I checked it out from the library and it promptly disappeared within 24 hours of entering our home. It has not turned up to this day, which confirms, well, it doesn't confirm, but it, what's that? What's the word? Corroborates?
Yes.
Corroborates. Yes. It corroborates my theory that Hadley in her toddlerhood threw my book away. And so I ended up going to the library and paying the fine, which was like $14. And then the book was like, it wasn't tainted in my mind, but I was like, I feel like I just bought this book and I didn't. So I just sort of let it fall off the radar for, you know, 2 years, mm-hmm. maybe longer than that, maybe closer to 3 years. And I finally went back and bought it with a gift card and read it. So Euphoria is about, it's based on Margaret Mead's life, actually, the anthropologist Margaret Mead. It's loosely based on her. And it follows three anthropologists in the wild jungles of New Guinea, I guess. And it's, mm-hmm. just it's one of those books that's difficult to describe because plot wise it's rather slow and not that much happens, but there's lots of character development, mental, emotional type of drama. So it's not something that you can really describe the plot of too well, but I did enjoy it. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, which I think is a sentiment you share. But yes. It's slow. It takes a while to get into it. You have to really appreciate the solid writing. It's very, mm-hmm. very well written. There are point of view switches that are also very well done. You have to appreciate good writing and good characterization, I think, in order to enjoy this book. And the setting reminded me a little bit of The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver, which is one of my all-time favorite books. So if you enjoyed that one, which is a more literary read, I would say, then maybe Euphoria would be a good pick for you also. So, yes, that was my read for this week. How about you?
I think you described that very well, because I remember recommending it to you because the writing was stellar and because it had a little bit more of an ambiguous ending, which you tend to like as well, or not even ambiguous so much as not everything was wrapped up with a bow on top, mm-hmm. which are the kind of books that you tend to dislike. So
yes.
I thought Euphoria would be great. And I just remember reading that book and having, I think there was like a sentence or two, maybe almost all the way at the end of the book, that you read that sentence or two and like this underlying plot thread hits you over the head and you can like think back to all of these different moments in the book that was leading you to this point, but you had no idea. And I just thought it was, in addition to being very well written, it was very, very well constructed. And I think those are two very different skills, and to find them in one book is just kind of a gift.
Yes, I totally agree. And I did enjoy the ending. I could see a lot of people not liking it, but I liked it. I felt like the ending went where it had to go. And so I am actually pretty pleased with how that book turned out. It's not one that I would necessarily go back and reread, and it's not one mm-hmm. that I would recommend to everybody, but I think it was definitely worth it.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. Finally got around to it.
it happens. Well, I have not been reading too much. I'm a few dozen pages into The Art of Memoir by Mary Carr. And I heard Mary Carr interviewed when she was on the circuit for this latest book a couple of years ago. And her interview was really fascinating. I mean, she is a force, is, I guess, the best word that I can use to describe her. She's incredibly confident and knows what she wants and where she's going. And I loved listening to her. So often I think we as writers we're not as outspoken maybe as mm-hmm. our books are, because we write things, we don't speak them. So hearing her be interviewed and hearing just what a force she was, I really wanted to read this book. So it finally came up for me at the library, and I'm only a handful of pages in, and I'm not sure it's the right book for me right now. And I haven't quite pinned it, and maybe it's just because the book is still setting up. She's still talking about influences and all of that, but she's been throwing like a ton of names and books and things into the mix that I have never even heard of, and I'm feeling a little bit intimidated. And I know you have tried to read this as well. Is that kind of the feeling that you got?
Yeah, I bought this book when it first came out, sight unseen. Like, I didn't know anything about it other than the title and that it was by Mary Carr, who is a mm-hmm. wonderful, wonderful memoirist. And I was just like, yes, I want to own this. And I tried reading it when I first bought it. And I can't remember exactly when it came out, but I want to say it was fall. And I also want to say that it was the fall right after I had one of my kids, because both my kids are August babies. So I was probably not in the right mindset to get very far in a book about writing when I was not doing any writing. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up again in November, I want to say, and tried getting through it. And it just was not happening for me. And I'm not sure why that is, because I can tell that it's something I would have gobbled up in college. Like, when I was in my writing classes, I would have loved this book. And the reading isn't particularly difficult. Like you said, she throws around a lot of examples from authors that I have not read, which kind mm-hmm. of just makes me feel like maybe I should be reading more memoirists. And the conversations that she's having are very interesting. At the beginning, she talks a lot about truth and like how to tell the emotional truth without mm-hmm. Violating the rights of the other people who appear in your book, and without misrepresenting them, especially when it comes to dialogue, and how she handles that. And it's a very fascinating conversation, and one that's extremely relevant for anybody who writes memoir or even shorter creative nonfiction, which is what I've been writing lately, is like shorter essays. And for whatever reason, I just ended up putting the book down again. And I don't know if it's maybe just in this season of life with little kids, and mm-hmm. I'm kind of starting to train my sights on more fiction writing, and so maybe the memoir stuff is falling by the wayside for me. But I have had the same problem that you did with that book twice now.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if it is because her writing isn't fluffy. It's quite dense, and you really need to like sit down and focus. And I don't think either of us are at points in our life where we get to sit down for any length of time and really just read. So maybe that's our issue.
That could definitely be. And I think it's also that I find myself wanting to stop and take notes on it, because mm-hmm. I feel like if I had finished reading it when it first came out or a few months ago in November, all the information would be gone from my head already. And so maybe that's why I'm kind of pulling back from it, is because I feel like it's not worth it to push through a book when I'm not going to remember anything from it right now. And I need to wait mm-hmm. until I have time to dig into it and to make notes and really make a study of it.
That makes complete sense, because the book is kind of a loose adaptation of the classes she teaches at a university. And she teaches how to write memoir. So I think it's almost one of those books that you have to take as if it's a class that you're like doing an independent study on, and really dig in and learn things and not just read about them.
Yeah. Well, there you go. We have cracked the code. We now know why this book, which it seems to have all this promise and goodness, why neither of us can get through it.
Yeah, we're just not ready to be students yet, which yes. is very accurate.
But for anybody who maybe is in that space, or they are currently a student, or they have children mm-hmm. who are old enough to like somewhat physically take care of themselves, and they have 30 minutes a day to read without being interrupted about sippy cups and going potty, then you know, maybe this is a good recommendation for them.
yeah. And if you read it, we want to hear about it. So
yes.
let us know what you think. You can find us at Brooks Editorial or at Abigail E. Krebs. We're mostly hanging out on Instagram these days, but sometimes you'll find us on Twitter. Or you can email us at chasingcreativepodcast@gmail.com. So until next time.
Thanks for listening to the Chasing Creative Podcast. If you like what you heard in this episode, be sure to stop by chasingcreative.com to check out the show notes, catch up on past episodes, and subscribe to the podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love it if you'd leave us a review on iTunes. You can also join in the creative conversation by tweeting to us at Abigail E. Krebs or at Brooks Editorial, or by using the hashtag #ChasingCreative on Twitter and Instagram.
If you'd like to help us bring this podcast to life each week, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/chasingcreative.
And if you have any feedback for us, drop us a line at chasingcreativepodcast@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening. Until next week, go chase your creative.